This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the Buick Enclave, the finest luxury crossover ever. Visit buick.gm.ca to see that where there's passion, there's beauty.
I'm Pedro Mendez. This is Editor's Choice. All this week, we present the 2006 Massey Lectures, The Ethical Imagination by medical ethicist Margaret Somerville. Science and technology confront us with some of the most challenging and unprecedented ethical questions in the world today. Margaret Somerville discusses how we can find a shared ethic for an interdependent world. This is part two.
In my book, The Ethical Canary, I introduced this concept that I called the secular sacred. It was more or less a throwaway line that I added as the book was about to go to press. But over time, it's come to play a major role in my thinking about ethical issues. I note in passing that it seems more than a coincidence to me that the Massey lecture that includes musings about the sacred should be delivered on the sacred rock, Newfoundland. I propose that linking the secular and the sacred is one key to finding a shared ethics. Those whose source of ethics is God or God nature, God and his creation including humans, will have a concept of the religious spiritual sacred and accept that certain moral and ethical principles flow from that. Those such as German philosopher Jürgen Habermas with his Ethics of the Human Species see their source of ethics as innate human morality. They have a concept of what I'm calling the secular sacred and accept that certain moral and ethical principles that should be respected and should govern our conduct flow from that secular sacred. For instance, they'll accept that certain aspects of life are sacrosanct. Not everything that could be done to life, in particular human life, may ethically be done to it. What the people who accept the religious sacred and the secular sacred have in common is a concept of the sacred. And where the two coincide is where the religious sacred and the secular sacred overlap. The substantive content of that overlap can form the basis for a shared ethics. Both approaches contrast with what's called a moral relativist approach that rejects the religion and any other external moral authority, as well as any moral base intrinsic to humans. As a consequence of this rejection, this approach employs no concept of the sacred. In order to examine more closely the concept of the secular sacred, let's begin by looking at what might be necessary features of one part of that term, the sacred. First, that which we consider sacred must have some kind of authenticity. Apart from utility, personal preference, or a desire that something be sacred, it must have what I'd call in inverted commas a life of its own. I recognize that authenticity is a philosophically loaded concept and that what constitutes authenticity is much disputed. Here I simply leave open what that authenticity might be. My point, rather, is that something more, some intrinsic characteristics which may be symbolic, is required to constitute the sacred. For those who are religious, the authenticity of the sacred is determined by God and God's will as to how we should act towards God and God's creation, other humans, other animals, or forms of life, the natural world. For people who are not religious in the orthodox sense, the authentically sacred in the form of the secular sacred can be found in the essence of being human, the search for morality, exercising the power to become fully oneself, undertaking the search for meaning in life. For many people, a belief in and respect for human rights and what they protect can be seen as one example of the non-religious sacred. I also recognize that what's regarded as sacred by religions or in a secular context can be culture specific, and that the degree to which the sacred is associated with either numinous or everyday experiences varies greatly across cultures and religions. But the important point is that all cultures and all religions have a sense of the sacred, even if some might not characterize it as such, and although its content varies greatly from one to the other. The commonality is that the sacred is special in its most generic sense, and the profane, the non-sacred, is ordinary. The authentically sacred might also be experienced and as a result identified in a sense of wonder and awe. The sacred then requires that we respect the integrity of the elements that allow us to fully experience being fully human, and in doing so, we protect that experience. Likewise, an element of being fully human is to experience the sacred. This circularity brings to mind, again, the mythical image of the snake swallowing its tail that I referred to in the first lecture. It's probably no accident that it often seems appropriate to use this image to explain some aspect of what's involved in doing ethics. There is often a circularity, not a linear progression from one point to another in our search for ethics. We could say that what goes around comes around. Indeed, I do not see doing ethics as a linear progression from A to B. Rather, doing ethics requires us to set off from A, enter what I think of as a conceptual metaphorical sphere, where we are more or less sort of like being put in an ethics tumble dryer. Everything gets put in and sort of spun around, and that we hope we emerge wrinkle-free at a point B where we've found the ethics that we need through that experience. Another way to explain it is that we start off from true simplicity, often thinking we know what we need for ethics, and then we enter a state of chaos as we learn more, chaos and confusion, and eventually we sort that out and we come out at point B, which often looks a lot like the first point. It often looks very similar. The difference is that then we understand why we're structuring our ethics in the way that we're structuring them, and not simply doing it from some rather superficial basis we might have been originally. To summarize, we need to experience awe and wonder to access a sense of the sacred, but in turn, that sense of the sacred can be the doorway to awe and wonder. In talking about the secular sacred, I'm proposing that the sacred is not only a concept that applies in a religious or ritualized context, but also one that operates at a general societal or secular level. I'm proposing it as a concept that encapsulates an experience that we might use to help people find their most authentic individual selves. Now, I really hasten to add that this is not to endorse intense individualism, of which I'm a well-known critic. Indeed, my intent is exactly the opposite. I believe our most authentic selves are to be found in the complex interaction of knowing ourselves, relating to others, appreciating our place in the great web of all life, and seeing ourselves as part of the earth, the stars, the universe, and the cosmos. Some scientists tell us that we came from stardust, that the earliest form of life on Earth might have arrived in meteorites. This brings to mind the Ash Wednesday liturgy. Remember, man, thou art but dust, and unto dust thou shalt return. If we rephrase that liturgy, remember, man, thou art stardust, and under stardust thou shalt return, what a magical difference. Those facts, assuming that they will prove to be correct, and the idea that science can verify them, is astonishing and wondrous. We humans are the wondrous outcome of the combination of stardust and time, whoever or whatever we believe was the origin of the process that resulted in us. The acute and continuous awareness of a mind-blowing web of relationships of all life, that is what I call the human spirit. The sacred is rightly enlisted when it will protect and promote that spirit, and wrongly used when it will do harm to it. Adopting the idea of the secular sacred gives us the conceptual tool we need to protect that which we hold most precious, in particular life itself. Now, it may seem selfish of us to be worrying about experiencing the sacred in our lives when there are millions of people in the world facing war and natural tragedies and starvation, without clean water to drink and without shelter, who have no access to even the most basic medical care, and whose children die in hundreds of thousands each year? What about the secular sacred in their lives? How can we speak of the secular sacred in our lives when we turn a blind eye to tragedies such as those Stephen Lewis described in last year's massive lectures, The Race Against Time, that arise out of the spread of HIV/AIDS in Africa? To do so seems like ultimate hypocrisy, and sadly in some ways it is. But I propose we might also respond to such tragedies as a society more adequately and ethically if we have a sense of the secular sacred. And having that sense requires us to recognize and talk about it. How then do we experience the sacred in our secular societies? What we regard as sacred is often associated with that which elicits feelings of awe and wonder, a primordial sense of amazement. Many people experience that feeling on first seeing their newborn baby. We can also experience it in our everyday lives when we watch a magnificent sunset, hear the birds' dawn chorus, play with a kitten or puppy, see two foxes wandering in the moonlight along a grassy treed slope beside a busy downtown expressway, as I recently saw in Montreal, or gaze at a pair of blue herons flying home at sunset high over a great river, which I see out of my window each evening. We've experienced the sacred when we're surrounded by beautiful music or art, feel an intimate bond with another human, or have the intricacies and order of the universe revealed to us by science. A sense of the sacred is present when we feel awe at being alive and conscious of the beauty, world, and life around us. The companion experiences to awe and wonder, that is the sacred, are fear and trembling, the taboo. A secular society also still needs the concept of a taboo. A taboo protects that which we hold most dear, that which we hold sacred. In other words, the taboo and the sacred are two sides of the same coin, and we need secular concepts of both in searching for a shared ethics. Fear and trembling have been wrongfully used by some people to control others, often in the name of religion, and we have rightly condemned and sought to prevent that abuse. But in throwing out fear and trembling, we may also throw out awe and wonder, and that's a big mistake. Fear can be destructive, pathological fear, but it can also be protective, healthy fear. We need healthy fear to protect our individual physical being and also our collective metaphysical being, our values, ethics, and shared morality, which are important elements of what can be called society's psyche. Moreover, we need to have a healthy fear for the well-being of future generations if we are to hold the future on trust for them. To take a lesson from First Nations people, in formulating ethical questions, we would do well to ask, what does looking back seven generations teach us about the issues we now face? And what does looking forward seven generations warn us about those issues? And what impact might our planned actions, for example, to alter our children's genes or to legalize euthanasia, have on our descendants seven generations from now? The right question, for instance, to ask about euthanasia is not what do we think it might happen with it now. The right question to ask, in my opinion, is how do we want our great-great-great-grandchildren to die? Because what we decide now will be what will affect them in the future. Asked another way, what are our present ethical obligations to future generations? What must we regard as sacred and hold on trust for them in order not to leave them worse off than we are or with less choices or options than we have? What do we owe them? What does an ethics of responsibility, as compared with an ethics of rights, require of us? The entities that need to be seen as secular sacred and held on trust must extend beyond physical realities to include important metaphysical realities, in particular important shared societal values such as respect for all life. In short, we still need taboos, and we still need the taboo's companion concept, that of the sacred. We have, however, lost access, or at least easy access, to both concepts in determining the ethics of much of our conduct in our contemporary world. I propose we urgently need to rediscover these concepts of the sacred and the taboo if we're to make ethical decisions about, for instance, new reproductive technologies. And we also need to find them in order to act ethically in the face of horrible new possibilities opened up by the life science. For instance, those of bioterrorism. If we are to ensure that the life sciences do not become the death sciences in the hands of terrorists. Concepts of the secular sacred and the secular taboo will not be sufficient to ensure that such abuse does not occur, but they will help us to determine how to think and act ethically. If we hope to persuade others to act ethically, we must first ensure that we act ethically ourselves, despairing as we might sometimes feel about whether or not it will make any difference. I spoke in the first lecture about my belief in the importance of moral intuition as a way of knowing about ethics. Now I add this further consideration. Might a sense of the sacred be necessary to maintaining our capacity for moral intuition? Just as our muscles deteriorate if we don't engage in physical exercise, it seems reasonable to assume that our other capacities, such as moral intuition, or say our capacity for compassion, might deteriorate if not used regularly. We know that failure to be sensitive to ethical issues in an institution, company, or workplace makes future failures more likely. It creates what we call in ethics a low ethical tone. And the contrary is true when there's sensitivity to ethical issues, we create a high ethical tone. Perhaps we could regard regular recognition of the secular sacred as yoga for our moral intuition. And vice versa, practicing compassion, for instance, might allow us to experience the sacred. One important question about the sacred is, what should it be used to protect? I suggest the essence of our humanness, for one. The progression of science's ability to change the human body has been breathtakingly fast. Starting with transplants and cosmetic surgery, and moving on to creating chimeras, human-animal combinations, and cyborgs, human-machine combinations. For the people who promote and laud such developments, the natural essence of being human has no element of the sacred, and therefore contains nothing that must be protected and preserved through restricting what we can do in light of what we ought not to do in order to maintain the integrity of our humanness. It's probably a mistake to see the secular and the sacred as being opposites. Rather, the pure secular and the pure sacred are opposite poles of a continuum, and the secular sacred is comprised of varying degrees of each. For example, in order not to offend its sacredness, Balinese temple dance was intentionally altered to be profane before it was performed as entertainment outside the temple. But the form of dance that developed as entertainment was so beautiful, it was taken back into the temple, at which point it again became sacred. The nature of any conduct, its purpose, and the setting in which it takes place are relevant when determining whether something is purely secular or purely religious sacred or secular sacred. Moreover, one person witnessing a dance in a temple could experience it as secular, another as religious sacred, and another as secular sacred, depending on the beliefs of each of those persons. All of this taken together tells us that the sacred has intrinsic and subjective elements, as well as extrinsic and objective ones, and the sacred might well require the presence of all of these features to be both seen and experienced as authentic.
This is Ideas on CBC Radio 1 and on Sirius Satellite Radio 137. I'm Paul Kennedy. From the Arts and Culture Center in St. John's, Newfoundland, you're listening to A Poetry of Ethics, Creating a Language of the Ethical Imagination, the second of the 2006 Massey Lectures. In this lecture, Margaret Somerville says that finding a shared ethics requires that both believers and non-believers learn to cross boundaries that have traditionally separated us.
Now I want to turn to the topic of the importance of language in finding and doing ethics. One link between the sacred and ethics is that both are mediated, at least in part, through words, often in the form of poetry or poetic language. Poetry is the language of the human spirit, the language through which we have access to the inchoate worlds we must enter to fully experience our humanness. Poetry comes into existence when the words of the poet create the music of the poem. Hearing both the words and their music can give us access to the ways of knowing in addition to reason that we need to use in ethics. In particular, poetry is the major language of the imagination. So let's now have a closer look at the links between poetry and the language of ethics and see how these links might help us to find a shared ethics. In short, words matter. Language is never neutral in ethics, and our choice of words and language involves danger and opportunity, two words that in combination mean crisis in Mandarin Chinese. And in many ways, choosing our language is one of the greatest challenges in searching for shared ethics in a global world. Words can attract or repel, reveal or conceal, calm or anger, give or take power, create or destroy trust. I've long thought that we'll find a shared ethics through the language of poetry, not the language of rationality. This does not mean that reason is irrelevant to the search for a shared ethics, or that the ethics we find will be irrational, although it might well be non-rational, that is, based on ways of knowing other than reason. In other words, as I've emphasized many times, all our human ways of knowing are needed in the search for a shared ethics, and we must choose our language with the goal of having access to all those ways of knowing in mind. I believe the language of poetry is the way in which we can best have access to many of these ways of knowing. We need a language of moral imagination and moral intuition because it's primarily through imagination and intuition that we can deepen the understanding we require to make decisions on ethical matters. Reason is also an essential way of knowing, but I've long argued that it often functions as a secondary verification mechanism to make sure that our other ways of knowing have not led us astray. Language can be used to create walls and to demolish them, whether those walls are literal or metaphorical, just by making us aware of their presence and impact. The Soweto poet Oswald Mashali's poem Walls raises such awareness and anticipates what's needed to demolish the walls he describes. He writes, "Man is a great wall builder. The Berlin Wall, the Wailing Wall of Jerusalem. But the wall most impregnable has a moat flowing with fright around his heart. A wall without windows for the spirit to breeze through. A wall without a door for love to walk in." In the past, the arts, including poetry, were closely entwined with religion. The great religious texts relied on poetry because, like all true art, poetry gives us access to metaphysical and spiritual realities. Just as the molecules that make up a genome, when organized in particular ways, come to life as each living being, so poetry gives life to words. Words are the nucleotides, metaphors and analogies the genes, The images and insights they code for, as the genome does, are the proteins. The composite entity of thoughts and feelings the poem conveys is the living organism that results. In secular societies, we do not use religious language to debate public policy, but we have no robust, comprehensive, and widely shared vocabulary of the imagination, that is, no substitute language to replace it. But while philosophers, scientists, politicians, and bureaucrats lack such a language, people who create and use popular culture, especially in the genre of science fiction, may be developing their own language of the imagination. Some of us may disagree with the aesthetics of these productions, or indeed the morality of them. The fact is, however, that they do explore many universal and existential problems, and often quite effectively. They're creative, they're imaginative, they're even poetic. Popular culture, in fact, is the chief venue of secular myths. So from an ethics perspective, we need to pay close attention to what those myths are. Nevertheless, we lack a secular ethical vocabulary to express institutional and societal ethical concerns, such as respect for and protection of important values in those contexts. In the past, we used religious language even in non-religious settings, for example, in the courts, legislature, and the public square. Many people, even those who are religious, recognize this is not possible today, if for no other reason than the existence of many different religions in each society. In contrast, we have a well-developed commercial language and increasingly a bureaucratic language that is applied far beyond the confines of commerce and bureaucracy. A major problem and danger is that these languages are being used in contexts where they distort the ethical issues raised. For instance, to discuss new reproductive technologies or therapeutic cloning and embryo stem cell research using only commercial or bureaucratic language means we either lose the ethical dimensions that must be taken into account, or we confuse the ethical dimensions with material or commercial ones. I was recently asked to review a draft UNESCO report which was dealing with the funding of ethics research, and they set out in it the criteria that should inform their decisions about which research should be funded and which should not. One of the major criteria was, what are the ethics deliverables? Can you imagine that? You're going to have ethics deliverables. Enough said. We need to find a new poetic language for ethics that's acceptable to and can accommodate everyone. We need such a language to deal not with deliverables, but with the much larger challenge of finding a shared ethics. I spoke earlier of our need for some new concepts, in particular the concept of the secular sacred. We should keep the requirements for implementing that concept in mind when seeking a poetry of ethics, because the secular sacred's existence, content, and capacity to contribute to better ethical decision-making will largely depend upon the language, especially the metaphors, analogies, and rhetoric, as well as the modes of argumentation we choose to employ in our ethics talk that we use to develop a shared ethics. That is, searching for a shared ethics, we need a language that can give us access to reason, but also take us beyond reason and give us access to our other ways of knowing if we are to find a shared ethics. We bond to each other and form societies by telling each other stories that we can all buy into. These stories encompass our most fundamental and important values, principles, attitudes, beliefs, and myths. Poet Clive Doucette, speaking about the role stories play in forming nations, uses an image that will be familiar to Newfoundlanders. He says, "Nations are like icebergs. 80% of them are invisible. The ice below the surface of the ocean creates a platform on which the beautiful white columns of the iceberg are able to thrust towards the sky. But without that undersea platform, the largest part, the iceberg turns over and is no more. Stories are the platform on which a nation floats. Stories are also the platform on which a global community and a shared ethics for a global community must float, which means the language and words we use to tell those stories are immensely important. Our challenge is to find the language to tell the stories that will allow us to find a shared ethics. We must see that challenge as an exploration of the human heart, mind, and spirit, an adventure, a struggle to understand if we're to find the stories that we need. In the end, perhaps the best that we can do in our search for a shared ethical language is to search for consensus through dialogue and through the articulation of as much as possible inclusive images and metaphors. And we should see the effort as an ongoing dynamic process, not an event with an endpoint. We have much work to do in developing an ethics of complexity and uncertainty. And learning to live comfortably with uncertainty is a fundamental requirement for developing an ethics of complexity and consequently for doing ethics. We make many, many, many ethical mistakes because we're uncomfortable with or even fearful of uncertainty. The German philosopher Theodor Adorno said, "The highest form of morality is not to feel at home in one's own home." I take that to mean that we must always be questioning our ethics if we are to remain ethical. We must always be open to being uncertain and listen to that uncertainty. And we must try to be respectful of others in their views and open-minded in our ethics talk. I suggest that the experience of ethical uncertainty and doubt is common to us all, but rather than that being a problem, it's a requirement for acting ethically. As part of a shared ethics base, we could agree on the need to protect the conditions that will allow people to experience and to express ethical uncertainty and doubt. Indeed, perhaps we have to be comfortable with uncertainty and doubt before we can experience wonder and awe at contemplating the unknown. I've thought for a long time that a sense of awe and wonder about what we know we don't know is an important element of high ethical intelligence. It generates humility in the face of our amazing new knowledge, and that in turn generates respect, perspective, and restraint. Once we accept the unavoidable presence of uncertainty, our understanding of truth and consensus in ethics shifts. We no longer speak about truth only in an objective scientific sense, nor do we speak about it only in a metaphysical sense. Rather, the kind of ethical truths we look for, those on which we can agree, are forms of what I've called temporal truth, always open to challenge, of course, and to change. Some of us would see any such change as a change in the truth. Others would see it as a clarification or correction of our previously inadequate or mistaken articulation of the truth. In other words, the concept of temporal truth in no way denies that there can be eternal truth. Rather, if we believe in eternal truth, we hope that what we see as temporal truths are partial manifestations of it.
This is Ideas on CBC Radio 1 and on Sirius Satellite Radio 137. I'm Paul Kennedy. From the Arts and Culture Center in St. John's, Newfoundland, you're listening to A Poetry of Ethics, Creating a Language of the Ethical Imagination, the second of the 2006 Massey Lectures. We need a poetry of ethics, Margaret Somerville argues in this lecture, a language of the ethical imagination that we can all accept and use.
The way in which I see truth can be described with another metaphor, one that can be added to that of the double helix. I start by imagining that that which we're looking at, in order to discover the truth about it, whether it's a person, an object, an idea, a theory, a principle, or belief. I then imagine that thing being in the center of a big circle, and imagine all the people who are looking at it standing around the circumference of that circle, each holding a light. The lights are of different kinds and have different colored lenses, and a few of them fail to work. Their batteries are dead, or they show a distorted image. What they show is not true. Some of the lights were invented recently and show us truths we didn't know before. Others are old and show us truths that we still need. The different colored and different kinds of lights reveal different aspects of the entity we're looking at. These aspects are not all the same, but they are all aspects of the truth of this entity. Moreover, just as combining blue and yellow gives green, the combination of two or more lights can show us a new reality, different from those shown by each light separately. When these different aspects are so compatible that they can all be combined, we get the white light of ethical insight. This metaphor captures the idea that there can be equally valid but different versions of the truth about something, rather than one person or body having the full and exclusive truth and others having no access to it. Each version of the truth might or might not be held in common by a large number of people who might or might not realize that commonality. Sometimes, however, two different colored lights will show us that we have conflicting values, and then we must make a difficult choice between those values. For instance, a value of caring for individual patients tells us that we should provide all cancer treatments that are likely to be beneficial. A value of protection of the common good tells us we should not do so if that will exhaust our healthcare resources and bankrupt the system to the serious detriment of people with other illnesses. Such value conflicts are often found in situations having to do with the protection of public health, the values of liberty and autonomy of individuals to decide for themselves what may be done to them, are preempted by compulsory treatment and quarantine when illnesses from which those individuals suffer pose a serious threat to the health of the community. The idea of seeing the multifaceted truth of something through the use of different colored lights is analogous to the idea that we can see different aspects of reality through the various ways of human knowing, whether, for instance, moral intuition, imagination and creativity, examined emotions or reason, or we can see different aspects of a given reality, for example, through the lenses of different disciplines, such as philosophy, psychology, religious studies, science, and social sciences, or through methodologies, such as establishing the cultural universality of some institutions, beliefs, values, perceptions, or ideas. We all hold them. We can consider these various ways of exploring to be different lights that together have the capacity to show multiple aspects of a reality. The idea of a multi-part truth leads me to another point. I believe the idea that nothing is true unless we can scientifically prove it is getting in the way of finding a shared ethics. Rather, we should see science as just one lens on the truth, a very important one, but only one. And what we see as the truth, even scientific truth, can change over time. We need to differentiate between when such change occurs in our perceptions of a reality and when the change occurs in the reality itself. Why couldn't we say that for medieval people it was true the world was flat because what they could perceive of it was flat? For us, it's true that the world is a sphere because we can now perceive it that way. But that's not inconsistent with our day-to-day experience of the world as being flat. But might we see it as something else in the future? For instance, some part of a larger whole? Or all or none of these, depending on the lens through which we view the world? Sometimes the scientific theory we use can change our perception of a reality, But those different perceptions can all be equally true, and no one of them might give us a complete picture. Take the example of light. Seen as a wave, it has one set of characteristics, seen as particles, another set. But both descriptions are equally true of light, or at least they both allow us to explain aspects of the behavior of light. In short, it may be our perceptions that change rather than the nature of what we perceive. Applied to moral principles, such an understanding allows us to postulate the existence of a stable moral base that exists and we can all share, while at the same time acknowledging that what we can share of it at any given time is a reflection of what we can see and find of it at that time. Earlier in this lecture, I discussed the importance of our choice of language in doing ethics. It's also important for us to decide upon the function of language both in establishing ethics and finding a shared ethics. In my view, through ethics, we articulate the ethics that can constitute a shared base, but that shared base pre-exists its expression. In other words, we don't create ethics through the language we use. Rather, ethics already exists in some external source, whether God or natural morality, or as an intrinsic part of human nature, and language is the tool we use to articulate it. Whatever the source of ethics, we humans are by our nature ethics-seeking, which is part of meaning-seeking creatures. Language, stories, and myths are the tools we use to identify and articulate the ethics we find. In the same way, human rights pre-exist their enactment in declarations, charters, and constitutions. Those instruments are but one way, although an important way, of articulating them. But if all humans have an innate ethical sense, how can we account for so much diversity in the way we talk about morality? We need to recognize that while there can be many differences in the way we talk about morality, the content of our morality can be the same. I believe that in the West we make a serious mistake when we so often start our discussions of ethics and morality from a point of disagreement. This overemphasizes our disagreements and causes us to hardly notice there is much we can agree on, whatever the basis for the beliefs, principles, or values on which we do agree. The theologian-philosopher Bernard Lonergan describes the process of going from experience to insight to judgment as being the process of how we know and know that we know, and he says it's part of being innately human. I see no reason why this is any less true of ethical knowing than of scientific knowing or mathematical knowing or any other kind of knowing. If that process is a universal one, common to all humans everywhere and across time, we can propose that it could be the basis of a universal vision, to use Lonergan's term. Our task then is to find the shared content of that vision, that is, to find a shared ethics. The fact that judgment is involved in the process means that we will disagree in certain situations. It also means we must be able to live comfortably with uncertainty, because the need for judgment in a situation often means that it's one of uncertainty. Might philosopher Jürgen Habermas's insight that language and communication are innate to being human and therefore a foundation for a shared ethics be yet another way to express the possibility of the universal vision Lonergan describes? The same questions present themselves in philosopher Søren Kierkegaard's concept that morality is linked to protecting in each person the power to become fully themselves. Kierkegaard argues that we must safeguard each person's power to become fully themselves if each of us is to have the means to develop our own authentic identity, which includes a sense of morality and ethics. When we respect and protect that power of each person to become fully themselves, we are acting morally. And when we do not respect it, we are acting immorally. Might all these philosophers be expressing in different ways a universal idea about human morality and ethics? that there is a universal core we must struggle to identify in ourselves as both individuals and societies, and that there are also other features that vary from culture to culture, era to era, religion to religion. This approach accommodates both a shared core consisting of some central features, a shared ethical base, and depending on the issue and circumstances, to greater or lesser extents, a shared ethics, and it also allows for the variability of other features. Habermas also proposes that morality takes the form of different language games in different contexts. I believe that while this might be true on the surface, ultimately we're engaged in a single unifying morality game. We have to be if our world is to survive. Moreover, I believe that although language is an important form of the game, it's not, as Habermas argues, the only or ultimate form. That would be making language God. On the topic of language games, it's important to state that I do not see poetry as a language game. Rather, it's a way of knowing, a specific example of imagination and creativity. It reflects, creates, and communicates elements of the human spirit that are integral to finding our individual and shared human identity. And finding that shared identity is very closely bound up with finding a shared ethics. Rather, I'm arguing that the ethicist is like a poet. He or she must not only search out old metaphors and eliminate those that are harmful to others, but also string together new ones that broaden our moral base and ensure that certain fundamental rules are being obeyed. In short, through language, the ethicist has power and control over doing ethics. Now, of course, the words power and control, and especially in relation to language, should cause our ethics neurons to fire. Indeed, the words power and control bring to mind the concept of political correctness and how it's currently being used as a form of power and control. Is the ethicist's high degree of control over setting the ethics agenda, much like people's use of political correctness in some instances, that is, antithetical to fostering the freedom necessary for each person to become themselves? Is the ethicist's control anti-ethical? The answer, as it is to so many ethical questions, is that depends. But let me address that question with another one. Might it be that the two main groups of ethicists, the utilitarians and the principle-based ethicists, who are often regarded as being in conflict about ethics, are actually seeking the same freedom for each person, but through different lenses, approaches, philosophies, or values? In that case, where the ethicists disagree is on how best to ensure that each person can realize the freedom to become herself or himself. They do not disagree on the central importance of the freedom to each person. If that's true, they have more in common than they believe, and this could not only dispel fear about the ethicist's control of language, it might indeed be an important insight in helping us to find a shared ethics. I also believe that part of our freedom is that we must be free to make mistakes, and one hopes to learn from them in the process of becoming fully ourselves. I believe that we each must find ethics, morality, and spirituality for ourselves if we are to experience them authentically as intrinsic to ourselves and not something imposed on us from outside. That's not to say that we don't need outside assistance. We certainly do. And it might be that we especially need such help when we're children and young people. But as adults, we need to move on and rediscover or redefine ethics, morality, and spirituality for ourselves if we are to experience the full development of these capacities. In this lecture, I've been speaking of ethics and ethicists, poets and poetry, language and ethics. Many years ago, a very dear friend of mine, Dr. Norbert Gilmore, told me something I've never forgotten. He said it takes only one generation to turn a poet's words into bullets. That became a kind of mantra for me. The most important challenge for all of us in our contemporary world, but especially for ethicists, poets, and philosophers, is how to turn bullets or bombs or bioweapons into poets' words. The purpose of searching for a shared ethics, whether in our families, communities, countries, or for a global society of the future, is to enable that transformation from bullets, bombs, and bioweapons to words to take place. To the extent that we must fight, it must be with words, not weapons. Thank you.
That was part two of the 2006 Massey Lectures, The Ethical Imagination, by medical ethicist Margaret Somerville. We continue the series all week. For Editor's Choice, I'm Pedro Mendez. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.